Hello, and welcome to the Murder House Radio Show. I'm your host, X. On this show, we will be covering serial killers, killers, mass shooters, disappearances, true crime, and the most deplorable things and people in history. All that good, dark stuff. The Murder House Radio Show will be a radio show slash podcast. I'll be uploading videos every Friday at 4 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. Make sure you hit the like and subscribe button. Once you hit subscribe, hit the bell notification and select all to get all notifications if you are viewing on YouTube. And hit follow if you are listening on a podcasting platform. So sit down, get comfortable, grab a coffee or whatever your preferred beverage is, turn off the lights and enjoy the show. Today's episode will be on Ted Bundy, full name Theodore Robert Bundy. Before we get too far into this, the source I'm reading off of is the Wikipedia page. So, I'm not going to read everything, of course, so I don't get copyrighted. And I'm going to leave stuff out so you can go check it out yourself. Or leave what I leave out in the comments below if you know a lot about Ted Bundy. But let's continue. Ted Bundy was born Theodore Robert Corwell on November 24th. Fun fact is my birthday, 1946. He was an American serial killer who kidnapped, raped, and murdered numerous young women and girls during the 1970s, possibly starting earlier. After more than a decade of denials, he confessed to 30 homicides. So that's the number he confessed to. I think this monster, probably killed more than that, in my humble opinion. He committed those murders in seven states between the years 1974 and 1978. If you think about that, that's a short time span to kill a lot of people. But you know, you shouldn't really be killing anybody, so yeah, there's that. His true victim total is unknown and believed by some investigators to be higher. Yep, makes sense. There was this post on Facebook I saw or whatever. It was like, don't worry about women, chase that bag or something along those lines. And I commented, I was like, what if the women are in bags? And then I sent a gif of Ted Bundy, like the one in the picture I put in this. It was pretty funny. Yeah, I got a dark sense of humor. And then on that post, I also posted a picture of Tig from Sons of Anarchy saying, "This is why I beat hookers," which is also a good gif. It's funny. And that's a good show. But back on topic. Bundy was regarded as a handsome and charismatic, and traits that he exploited to win the trust of his victims. Yep. He would typically approach his victims in public places, faking injuries or disabilities, or he'd impersonate an authority figure before knocking them unconscious, usually with like a crowbar or something of the sort, and taking them to a secluded location to rape and strangle them. So that was his main method of murder, strangulation. He sometimes revisited his victims, grooming and performing sexual acts with the decomposing bodies until putrefaction and destruction by wild animals made any further interactions impossible. Let that one marinate. I think that's what separates serial killers from, like, normal killers and even normal people. Like, they do stuff like that and then, even going about dismembering someone, because, like, if you killed someone, like, whatever the circumstance was, even if you planned it or whatever, you probably wouldn't want to cut up the body. You'd probably just go bury it or go dump it somewhere. But it takes a different kind of person to go cut up a body or whatever. But he decapitated at least 12 of his victims and kept some of the severed heads as mementos in his apartment, which is pretty wild. On a few occasions, he broke into dwellings at night and bludgeoned his victims as they slept. If he lived today, he'd have all those sex dolls or whatever, and you could get, like, the feet, the necks, probably just a straight head or whatever. So, he probably could have prevented that killing. He could probably decorate it up, put some fake blood in there, you know. In 1975, Bundy was arrested and jailed in Utah for aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault. If they sentenced him longer, I guarantee they probably would have saved lives, but as you probably know, that's not the case. He then became a suspect in a progressively longer list of unsolved homicides in several states, for facing murder charges in Colorado. He engineered 2 dramatic escapes and committed further assaults in Florida, including 3 murders before his ultimate recapture in 1978. For the Florida homicides, he received 3 death sentences in 2 trials. Bundy was executed in the electric chair at Florida State Prison in Rayford, Florida, on January 24th, 1989. Alright, so there's a little, not recap, but a little summary of who this guy was, what he did, and all that stuff. But let's get into his early life. So his childhood, Ted Bundy was born Theodore Robert Corwell, as I said, to Eleanor Louise Corwell, which was his mother, and Elizabeth Lude home for unwed mothers. Oh, yeah, that's right. So, yeah, in Burlington, Vermont, his father's identity has never been confirmed. So, technically, he was a bastard child. But some accounts his birth certificate assigned paternity to a salesman and Air Force veteran named Lloyd Marshall. Although, according to others, the father is listed as unknown. Louise claimed she had been seduced by a sailor named Jack Worthington only, and the King County Sheriff's Office has him listed as the father in their files. Interesting. Some family members expressed suspicions that Bundy might have been fathered by Louise's own violent, abusive father, so possibly incest, Samuel Colwell. But no material evidence has ever been cited to support that theory. Interesting. But what do you think about that? Maybe if he was an incest child, that could play into his fucked up later adulthood tendencies. But for the first 3 years of his life, Bundy lived in Philadelphia with his maternal grandparents. And so his mother's grandparents, who raised him as their own son to avoid social stigma that accompanied birth outside of wedlock. Makes sense for the time. Family, friends, and even young Ted were told that Eleanor Colwell, that his grandparents were his parents, and that his mother was his older sister. That would definitely mess a kid up. He eventually discovered the truth, although he had varied recollections of the circumstances. He told a girlfriend that a cousin showed him a copy of his birth certificate and called him a bastard. That's kind of a dickhead move. But he told biographers Stephen Michaud and Hugh Ainsworth that he found the certificate himself, biographers and true crime writer Anne Rule, who knew Bundy personally, believed that he did not find out until 1969. So he possibly found out when he was 23. Imagine how possibly traumatizing that would be to find out your sister is really your mother and your alleged parents were your grandparents. But when he located his original birth record in Vermont, Bundy expressed a lifelong resentment towards his mother, possibly why he also started killing, which makes sense if you think about it, for never talking to him about his real father, and for leaving him to discover his true parentage for himself. Yeah, you'd think at a certain age, she would tell him or whatever. But in some interviews, Bundy spoke warmly of his grandparents and told Rule that he identified with, respected, and clung to his grandfather. In 1987, however, he had other family members told attorneys that Samuel Colwell was a tyrannical bully and bigot who hated blacks, Italians, Catholics, and Jews, so pretty much everybody, beat his wife and family dog, and swung neighborhood cats by their tails. He once threw Louise's younger sister, Julia, down a flight of stairs for oversleeping. Holy, what an alarm clock. Just kidding, that's fucked up. He sometimes spoke out loud to unseen presences, so he's crazy. And at least once flew into a violent rage when the question of Bundy's paternity was raised. So Bundy was like, yeah, my grandparents were cool people and I like my grandfather. And then others were like, his grandfather was a complete dickhead. But yeah, Bundy described his grandmother as a timid and obedient woman who periodically underwent electroconvulsive therapy, so electric shock therapy for depression, and feared to leave their house towards the end of her life. That's sad. Bundy occasionally exhibited disturbing behavior at an early age. Julia recalled awaking from a nap to find herself surrounded by knives from the kitchen and Bundy standing by the bed smiling. I wonder how old he was when that happened, because, you know, that's pretty fucking creepy. In 1950, his name actually changed, like his last name changed from Colwell to Nielsen. So is Theodore Ted Nielsen, technically. And then it was Ted Bundy. And at the urging of multiple family members, she left Philadelphia with her son to live with cousins Alan and Jane Scott in Tacoma, Washington. In 1951, Louise met Shawnee Culpepper Bundy. So that's when he got the name Bundy, when they eventually got married. But he worked in a hospital as a cook. And they met at an adult singles night in Tacoma's First Methodist Church. Sorry about my pronunciations and reading. Sometimes I can't pronounce words sometimes, and my brain moves too fast and all that type of stuff. ADHD at its finest. But they married later that year. So his name was Ted Bundy, the infamous name that we all know today. Johnny and Louise conceived four children, so he has four step-siblings. And although Johnny tried to include his new adoptive son into camping trips and other family activities, Ted remained distant, which is kind of normal, I guess, sometimes. He later complained to his girlfriend that Johnny wasn't his real father, wasn't very bright, and didn't make much money. What a savage. So Bundy had different memories of Tacoma, Washington. When he spoke to his biographers, he would describe how he roamed his neighborhood picking through trash barrels in search of nude pictures of women. When he spoke to Polly Nielsen, he explained how he pursued detective magazines, crime novels, and true crime documentaries, so much like a lot of the people listening to this now, for stories that involved sexual violence. Maybe not that part. If you seek out sexual violence stories, that's kind of a fucked up. Particularly when the stories were illustrated with pictures of dead or maimed bodies. Holy. In a letter to Rule, he asserted that he never ever read fact detective magazines. So it was all non-fiction, I guess. Fiction, not non-fiction. And shuddered at the thought that anyone would. Holy. In his conversation with Michaud, he described how he would consume large quantities of alcohol and canvass the community late at night in search of unwrapped windows where he could observe women undressing. So he was a peeping Tom, like Richard Ramirez. Kind of a little commonality in some killers. Or whenever else could be seen. Word. But, yeah. Bundy also, varied his accounts of his social life. He told Michaud and Ainsworth that he chose to be alone as an adolescent because he was unable to understand interpersonal relationships, whatever that is. He claimed that he had no natural sense of how to develop a friendship. Interesting. I don't know what made people want to be friends. Oh, that's definitely interesting. He said, I don't know what underlying social interactions. Classmates from Woodrow Wilson High School told Rule, however, that Bundy was well known and well liked. So maybe that's his lying coming into play. Medium-sized fish in a large pond. Also, he was just a normal, everyday dude. Had friends in other people's eyes. But, yeah. His only sport he was into downhill skiing, which he enthusiastically pursued, and he would even go as far to steal equipment and forge lift tickets. So a little bit of a juvenile delinquency. So during this time, he was arrested at least twice on suspicion of burglary and auto theft. So nothing too crazy. Arguably normal teenage behavior. When he reached 18, the details of the incidents were expunged from his record. Yeah, they weren't too serious, so it makes sense. Unlike Edmund Kemper. But, yeah. As is customary in Washington. Yeah, most parts of the world are like that, for the most part. If you commit certain crimes in America or whatever, you're not allowed to come to Canada. They'll reject you, and probably the other way around. But, yeah, it just depends on the crime. In 1965, Bundy graduated high school and went to the University of Puget Sound, UPS, for 1 year before transferring to the University of Washington to study Chinese. Interesting. In 1967, he became romantically involved with a University of Washington classmate who is identified by several pseudonyms in Bundy's biography, most commonly Stephanie Brooks. In the early 1968, he dropped out of college and worked a series of minuscule jobs. He also volunteered at the Seattle office of Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign. So he did get into politics on the Republican side. And, yeah. So he's a politician. And he became Arthur Fletcher's driver and bodyguard. So he's also a bodyguard. That's neat. During Fletcher's campaign for lieutenant governor of Washington State. In August 1968, Brooks ended their relationship and returned to her family home in California. And Bundy was frustrated by this. She described Bundy as immature and lacking ambition. I don't know, man. He's pursuing governor, a political office. So a psychiatrist, Dorothy Lewis, would later pinpoint this crisis as probably the pivotal time in his development. So his pivotal time in his urges to kill, maybe, is what she meant. But he was devastated by Brooks' rejection. Bundy traveled to Colorado and then farther east, visiting relatives in Arkansas and Philadelphia and enrolling for one semester at Temple University. It was at this time, in early 1996, Anne Rule believes that Bundy visited the Office of Birth Records in Burlington and confirmed his true parentage. Interesting. So in the fall of 1969, Bundy returned to Washington for, and he met Elizabeth Kolepfer, and she was a divorcee from Ogden, Utah, who worked as a secretary at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Their stormy relationship would continue well past his initial incarceration in 1976. Interesting. In mid-1970, Bundy now focused on goal-oriented, enrolled in the University of Washington, this time as a psychology major, which would probably help him with his killing. I wonder if he premeditated that or not. Like, hey, maybe this will help me with my killing. Or he got into it and then started killing after, and he's like, this will be useful, I guess. He became an honor student and was well regarded by his professors. So I think they fucked dog hard on this case, one, by letting him out on his first charges or whatever, like not sentencing him longer, and the fact that he was, sadly, a white, smart dude with university degrees, and kind of well off, and he's a politician, so yeah, they fucked dog hard on that one. But in 1971, he took a job at Seattle Suicide Hotline Crisis Center, where he met and worked alongside Anne Rule, a former Seattle police officer. An aspiring crime writer, she would later write one of the definitive Bundy biographies, The Stranger Beside Me. That's a fitting title. Rule saw nothing disturbing in Bundy's personality at the time, because he's a psychopath. And she described him as kind, solicitous, and empathetic. All traits of a serial killer. Yeah, if you all watch Bill Burr, he does his words like that sometimes. I watch him a lot and it gets stuck in my head. But he graduated from the University of Washington in 1972. And he joined Governor Danielle J. Evans' re-election campaign. So he was doing his, and he posed as a college student and shadowed Evans' opponent. Oh, so he's like spying for him. So yeah, he had a fruitful-ish career as a governor assistant person, a political person. And he graduated, so you know. But, forgive me for being all over the place and sometimes not sounding like I know what I'm reading, but I just don't want to read everything verbatim off of this website, so you know, just bear with me. During a trip to California for a Republican Party business meeting or something in September 1973, Bundy rekindled his relationship with Brooks. She marveled at his transformation into a serious, dedicated professional, seemingly on the cusp of a large political career. It's said that he did this just to prove that he could do it. Because he later just kind of ghosted her before ghosting was a thing. But he continued to date Culpepper as well. So he's wheeling. Neither woman was aware of the other. In the fall of 1973, Bundy matriculated at UPS Law School and continued courting Brooks, who flew to Seattle several times to stay with him. They discussed marriage at one point, introduced her to Davis as his fiancé. Oh. In January 1974, however, he abruptly broke off all contact. Yep, he ghosted her. So he ignored letters and phone calls from her. And, yeah. And finally reaching him by phone later, Brooks demanded to know why Bundy had unliterally ended their relationship without explanation. In a flat, calm voice, he replied, "Stephanie, I have no idea what you mean," and hung up. What a savage. She never heard from him again. She later explained, I just wanted to prove myself that I could have married her. I told ya. But Brooks concluded in retrospect that he had deliberately planned the entire courtship and rejection in advance as vengeance for the breakup she initiated in 1968. Makes sense. That's a pretty psychopathic or fucking sociopathic move. By then, Bundy had begun skipping classes at law school. By April, he had stopped attending entirely as young women began to disappear in the Pacific Northwest. Oh, climatic. So let's get into his murders. So his first two series of murders were in Washington, Oregon. There is no consensus on when or where Bundy began killing women. He told different stories to different people and refused to give up the specifics of his earliest crimes. Interesting. I wonder why. Maybe it's for attention, but like, he's already sentenced to death, so he might as well give everything up. But there again, could be a sick, twisted things like taking this to the grave and you're always gonna wonder about it kind of deal. But he confessed in graphic detail to dozens of later murders in the days preceding his execution. Oh. But he told Nielsen that he attempted his first kidnapping in 1996. In Ocean City, New Jersey, but did not kill anyone until 1971 in Seattle. He told psychologist Art Norman that he killed two women in Atlantic City in 1969, my bad guys, while visiting family in Philadelphia. Oh. He hinted but refused to elaborate to homicide detective Robert D. Keppel that he committed a murder in Seattle in 1972, and other murders in 1973 that involved a hitchhiker near Tumwater. Rule and Keppel both believed that he might have started killing as a teenager. Could make sense. Circumstantial evidence suggested that he may have abducted and killed 8-year-old Anne Marie Burr. Oh, damn. Of Tacoma while he was 14 years old in 1961, an allegation that he repeatedly denied. His earliest documented homicides were committed in 1974 when he was 27 years old. So he officially started killing when he was 27. By then, by his own admission, he had mastered the necessary skills in the era before DNA profiling to leave minimal incriminating forensic evidence for at the crime scene. So, he was a man of sheer precision at his art of killing. So, January 4th, 1974, shortly after he ended his relationship with Brooks, Bundy entered the basement apartment of 18-year-old Karen Sparks, identified as Joni Lenz in Mary, what identified as Joni Lenz, Mary Adams, and Terry Caldwell by various sources, a dancer and student at the University of Washington. After bludgeoning Sparks senseless with a metal rod from her bed frame, he sexually assaulted her with either the same rod or a metal speculum. Causing extensive internal injuries, she remained unconscious for 10 days in a coma, basically, but survived with permanent physical and mental disabilities. Yeah, I would bet. In the early morning hours of February 1st, Bundy broke into the apartment room of Linda Annie Hale at University of Washington undergraduate, who broadcast morning radio weather reports for Skyers. He beat her unconscious, dressed her in blue jeans, a white blouse, and boots, and carried her away. Holy. I won't be reading all of these. I will list them all, or whatever, all his known victims. And, yeah, but if you want to read further into these, the link will be in the description below, as always. But during the first half of 1974, female college students disappeared at the rate about one per month. On March 12th, Donna Gail Manson, a 19-year-old student at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, 60 miles southwest of Seattle, left her dormitory to attend a jazz concert on campus but never arrived. On April 17th, Susan Aline Rancourt disappeared while on her way to her dorm room after an evening advisory meeting at Central Washington State College in Elmsburg, 110 miles east-southeast of Seattle. Two female Central Washington students later came forward to report encounters, one on the night of Rancourt's disappearance, the other three nights earlier with a man wearing an arm sling, asking for help carrying a load of books to his brown or tan Volkswagen Beetle. So Bundy's usual stick. On May 6th, Robert Kathleen Parks left her dormitory at Oregon State University in Corvallis, 85 miles south of Portland, to have coffee with her friends at a coffee shop, but never arrived. Yeah. But yeah, the detectives got flabbergasted because he was leaving little physical evidence, and the missing women had little in common apart from being attractive white college students with long hair parted in the middle, his choice of victims. But Brenda Carol Ball, 22, disappeared after leaving the Flame Tavern in Burnie near Seattle Tacoma International Airport. She was last seen talking to Bundy, but was not known as Bundy at the time. He was described as a man with brown hair and his arm in a sling. Same as a bunch of other descriptions you will be hearing throughout this podcast and that you've already heard. During these disappearances, so this period, Bundy was working in Olympia as the assistant director of the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Commission. That's a tactical-ass spot to be working, conducting your evil deeds, where he wrote a pamphlet for women on rape prevention. That's ironic. Later, he would work at the Department of Emergency Services, DES, a state government agency involved in the search for the missing women. Holy, so this would help him, like, avoid the locations he dumped the bodies. My guy's smart. The DES he met. At DES, he met and dated Carol Ann Boone, a twice-divorced mother of two who had 6 years later would play an important role in the final phase of his life. Interesting. So, by then, the reports of the six missing women and Sparks' beating were appearing in newspapers and on the news and stuff throughout Washington. And this made people stand on edge or whatever, because they're like, oh, these are all connected, just not random or whatever. Hitchhiking by young women dropped sharply, makes sense. Pressure mounted on law enforcement agencies, but the lack of physical evidence severely hemmed them. People could not provide reports with the little information that was available for fear of compromising the investigation. Further similarities between the victims were noted. The disappearances all took place at night, usually near ongoing construction work, within a week of midterms or final exams. All of the victims were wearing slacks or blue jeans, and at most crime scenes, there were sightings of a man wearing a cast or an arm sling and driving a brown or tan Volkswagen Beetle. You would think they have this description out in the news, in the newspaper. You see anybody matching that description or a car matching that description, you wouldn't go near them and you would report them. But yeah, he also did all this by his own university, so you'd think people would notice him, like, right quick or whatever. Like, hey, that description sounds familiar. So the murders in the Pacific Northwest came to, like, a climax or whatever, or concluded July 14th on a broad daylight abduction of two women from a crowded beach in Lake Samanthish State Park, I hope I pronounced that right, in Isauka, a suburb 20 miles east of Seattle. So these are the ones that were definitely pinned on Bundy and started his downfall. So there were five girl witnesses who described an attractive young man wearing a white tennis outfit with his left arm in a sling, speaking with a light accent, perhaps Canadian or British, if you can tell. I'm pretty Canadian there, eh? What if he sounded like a stereotypical Canadian or something? Introducing himself as Ted, why would he use his real abbreviated name? He asked for their help unloading a sailboat from his tan or bronze-colored Volkswagen Beetle. Four refused. Smart. One accompanied him as far as his car, saw there was no sailboat, then fled. Three additional witnesses saw him approach Janice Ann Ott, 23, a probation caseworker at the King Court Juvenile Court, interesting, with the sailboat story, and watched her leave the beach in his company. Oh. About 4 hours later, Dennis Meyer Nastelude, a 19-year-old woman who was studying to become a computer programmer, left a picnic to go to the restroom and never returned. So two abductions in one day, I'm pretty sure here. Bundy told both Stephen Mashood and William Hammer that Otto was still alive. Ott was still alive when he returned with Nastelude, and that he forced one to watch as he murdered the other. but he later denied it in an interview with Lewis on the eve of his execution. Interesting. Sorry if that was all over the place, guys. A lot of names were hard to pronunciate, and it was a little all over the place. So after this event, the police were armed with a powerful description of the suspect and his car, and they posted flyers throughout the Seattle area. A composite sketch was printed in relation in newspapers and broadcasts on local television stations. Elizabeth Klepfer, Ann Rule, and DES employees and the University of Washington psychology professor all recognized the profile, the sketch, and the car, and reported Bundy as a possible suspect. If all these people who knew him came like separately and reported this, that should be enough to gain a lot of, but detectives who were receiving up to 200 tips per day, although it unlikely that a clean-cut law student with no adult criminal record could be the perpetrator. See what I mean? Like, fucked, dog. And it's sad, because you know the times, all that racial stuff we will not get into, that's not what this podcast is about. On September 6th, the remains of the two women who got abducted from the beach were discovered by hunters on a trail 2 miles east of the lake where they disappeared from. An extra femur and several vertebrae found at the site were later identified by Bundy as Georgenga Hawkins. I pronounced the fuck out of that wrong. I'm sorry. 6 months later, forestry students from Green River Community College discovered the skull and mandibles of Haley Rancourt Parks and Ball on Taylor Mountain, where Bundy frequently hiked just east of Issaquoa. Manson's remains were never recovered. Holy. So there were further murders in Idaho, Utah, and Colorado. I won't be going over every single one, but I'll give the victim list and all that stuff. So in 1974, in August, Bundy received a second acceptance from the University of Utah Law School. So he went back to law school and moved to Salt Lake City, leaving his girlfriend Klepfer in Seattle. While he called Klepfer often, he dated at least a dozen other women. So he's a womanizer. So he studied the first year of law school curriculum a second time. He was devastated to find out that the other students had some intellectual capacity that he did not. Oof. He found the classes completely incomprehensible. Maybe his deteriorating mind state, I'm not sure. "It was a great disappointment to me," he said. A new string of homicides began the following month. So he got some bad news and back on the killing rampage. So including two that would remain undiscovered until Bundy confessed to them shortly before his execution. On September 2nd, he raped and strangled a still unidentified hitchhiker in Idaho, then either disposed of the remains immediately in a nearby river or returned the next day to photograph and dismember the corpse. On October 2nd, he kidnapped 16-year-old Nancy Wilcox in Holladay, a suburb of Salt Lake City. Her remains buried near Capitol Reef National Park, some 200 miles south of Holladay, but were never found. Damn. So during this time, most of his victims were taken or whatever. Lots of them were undiscovered, and a lot of them as well were discovered naked in the woods and stuff like that. And yeah, But they only found most of them because he confessed to them where they were discovered and whatnot. So in November of 1974, Bundy was rising in suspicion in the King County, Herefordshire. So he was raising in suspicion in that county, so he moved east so he could continue his killings. Bundy's name was added to their list of suspects, but at the time, no credible forensic evidence linked him to the Utah crimes. In January 1975, Bundy returned to Seattle after his final exams and spent a week with Culpepper, who did not tell him that she had reported him to the police on three occasions. Holy. She made plans to visit him in Salt Lake City in August. Oh. So Bundy moved eastward and he started killing in Colorado. And after a bunch of killings, his name also appeared on the Colorado's lists of suspects for these murders. That is pretty wild. But, yeah. So, the police in Colorado compiled a few lists. Out of thousands of names, 26 turned up on four lists. One was Ted Bundy. Detectives also manually compiled a list of their 100 best suspects, and Bundy was on that list as well. He was literally at the top of the pile of suspects when word came from Utah of his arrest or whatever. Interesting. But, yeah, I think he should have been arrested way sooner. I think they had, sufficient evidence to arrest him on at least something to get him off the street. When do you think he, should have been arrested? Like, what point? Like, what arrest? When he was arrested? He was arrested a few times. But, yes, his first trial was on August 16th, 1975. Bundy was arrested by Utah Highway Patrol officer Bob Hayward in Granger, another Salt Lake City suburb. Howard had observed Bundy cruising a residential area in the pre-dawn hours. Bundy fled the area at a high speed after seeing the patrol car. The officer searched the car after he noticed that the Volkswagen's front passenger seat had been removed, suspicious, and placed on the rear seat. He found a ski mask, a second mask fashioned from pantyhose, a crowbar, handcuffs, trash bags, a coil of rope and ice pick, and other items initially assumed to be burglary tools. That is very fucking suspicious. I wonder what his excuse... Oh, Bundy explained that the ski mask was for skiing, obviously. He had found the handcuffs in the dumpster. Why you dumpster diving, bro? And the rest were common household items. Okay. However, Detective Jerry Thomas remembered a similar suspect and car description from November 1974 from the Danronach kidnapping, and Bundy's name from Klopfer's December 1974 phone call. Ooh, busted. Right there. Right there, he should have been imprisoned. In a search of Bundy's apartment, police found a guide to Colorado Ski Resort with the check mark by the Willow Inn and a brochure that advised the Viewmont High School play in Bountiful, where the Deborah Kent had disappeared. Oh. The police did not have sufficient evidence to detain Bundy. Fuck you, dude. You could have got him for kidnapping, you sons of bitches. And when he was released on his own recognition, Bundy later said that searchers missed a hidden collection of Polaroid photographs of his victims, which he destroyed after he was released. So they did a shit job of searching his apartment. Fucking embarrassing. When he was released, he was placed under 24-hour surveillance, and Thompson flew to Seattle with two other detectives to interview his girlfriend, or ex-girlfriend at this time, Culpepper, her name keeps changing, but it's the same person. She told them that in the year prior to Bundy's move to Utah, she had discovered objects that she couldn't understand in her house and in Bundy's apartment. These items included crutches, a bag of plaster of Paris that he admits stealing from a medical supply house, and a meat cleaver that was never used for cooking. Ugh. Additional objects included surgical gloves, okay, an oriental knife in a wooden case that he kept in his glove compartment, okay, that's a little weird, and a sack full of women's clothes, that's pretty fucking weird. Bundy was preemptively in debt, and Culpepper suspected that he had stolen almost everything in significant value that he possessed. Oh. When she confronted him over a new TV and stereo, he warned her, "If you tell anyone, I'll break your fucking neck." Holy, coming from Bundy, not knowing what she would know, that probably scared the shit out of her in retrospect, or whatever I guess you could say. She said Bundy became very upset whenever she considered cutting her hair, which was long and parted in the middle. She would sometimes awaken in the middle of the night to find him under the bed covered with a flashlight, examining her body. That's fucking weird. He kept a lug wrench taped halfway up the handle in the trunk of his car, okay? Another Volkswagen Beetle, which he often borrowed for protection. Oh. Detectives confirmed that Bundy had not been with Culpepper on any of the nights during which the Pacific Northwest victims had vanished. Ooh, no alibi there. Nor on the day Ott and Nalslund were abducted. Ooh, that's not a good look. Shortly thereafter, Culpepper was interviewed by Seattle homicide detective Kathy McChesney and learned of the existence of Stephanie Brooks and her brief engagement to Bundy around Christmas 1973. Ooh, shit's falling apart. Things are getting juicy. So Bundy sold his Volkswagen Beetle to a teenager. The Utah police impounded it, and the FBI technicians dismantled it and searched it. They found hairs matching samples obtained from Carrie Ann Campbell's body. Later, they also identified hair strands, microscopically indistinguishable from those of Melissa Smith and Carol Denoch. FBI lab specialist Robert Neal concluded that the presence of the hair strands in one car matching three different victims who had never once met each other would be a coincidence of mind-boggling rarity. So that's sufficient evidence enough right there on its own, arguably, to have him arrested, in my opinion. Because you can't really explain that. Because, like, there's really no possible explanation or reasoning for three people who have gone missing, all in different locations, for evidence of them being found in his car. That's just, yeah. Obviously, of course, it's, like, almost impossible for him to have to not have anything to do with it. But of course he did. Sorry if that made no sense. I'm having trouble putting things together right now for whatever reason. So on October 2nd, detectives put Bundy into a lineup. Dan Ronch immediately identified him as Officer Roseland. Also, she's a surviving victim, so they charged him with the kidnapping. And witnesses from Bonnie Field recognized him as a stranger at the high school auditorium. Whoa. There was insufficient evidence to link him to Deborah Kent, whose body was never found, though a skeleton fragment found near the school was later identified as Kent by DNA analysis. There was more than enough evidence to charge him with aggravated kidnapping and attempted criminal assault in the Danach case. Good. He was freed on a $15,000 bail, so you only have to pay like 5%, so whatever that comes out to. And this was paid by his parents, and spent most of his time between indictment and trial in Seattle, living in Klepfer's house. Oh, sorry if it sounds like I'm yelling, guys. Seattle police had insufficient evidence to charge him in the Pacific Northwest murders, but kept him under close surveillance. I don't understand why they gave him bail, man. They should have kept him in jail. When Ted and I stepped out on the porch to go somewhere, Klepfer wrote, so many unmarked police cars started up that it sounded like the beginning of the Indy 500. Oof. So, three people investigating Bundy's murders, all from different places, met up, and this was in November. These investigators' names are Jerry Thompson from Utah, Robert Keppel from Washington, and Michael Fisher from Colorado, met in Aspen, Colorado, and exchanged information with 30 detectives from each of their respected jurisdictions. Real professional. Prosecutors from five states, while officials left the meeting, later known as the Aspen Summit, convinced that Bundy was the murderer they sought. They agreed that more hard evidence would be needed before he could be charged with any of the murders. Yeah. All right, then. On February 1976, Bundy stood trial for the Danach kidnapping, and he was sentenced to 1 to 15 years in state prison. In October, he was found hiding in bushes in the prison yard with an escape kit, roadmaps in airline schedules, and a social security card, and spent several weeks in solitary confinement. Later that month, Colorado authorities charged him with Corrine Campbell's murder, so it sealed his fate. He's never getting out of prison. After a period of residence, he waived extradition proceedings and was transferred to Aspen in January 1977. But then he later escaped. Yeah. So, long story short, he escaped and then he hid in the mountains. He escaped because he was his own lawyer. He fired his lawyers and wanted to represent himself because he did graduate from law school, I'm pretty sure. It's bad of me, I don't remember that. But he jumped out the court window when he was unattended in the courtroom library because he could be in there unattended because he was technically his own lawyer or whatever. And then he hid for about a week. Oh, he was a fugitive for 6 days. And he was finally caught. He was pulled over or whatever. He tried to run away. And then he was tackled and handcuffed, all that stuff, and brought back. And he said to the person or whatever, you should have just killed me or whatever. But, yeah. Actually, that may have been the Florida escape. But that pretty much sums up the first escape. But when he was back in jail in Glenwood Springs, Bundy ignored the advice of friends and legal advisors to stay put. The case against him was already weak at best, and it was deteriorating steadily as paternal motions consistently resolved in his favor, and significant bits of evidence were ruled inadmissible. So he could have got away with the murder, but then he escaped again. So, Bundy assembled a new escape plan. He acquired a detailed floor plan of the jail somehow, and a hacksaw blade from other inmates, and accumulated $500 in cash smuggled in over a six-month period. It was later said by visitors, Carol Ann Boone in particular, Oh, so she's the one who gave that information, word. During the evenings, while other prisoners were showering, he sawed a hole about 1 square foot between his steel-reinforced bars in his cell ceiling, and having lost 35 pounds, he starved himself to fit through the hole, was able to wriggle through into the crawl space above his cell. In the weeks that followed, he made a series of practice runs, smart, exploring the space. Multiple reports from an informant of movement within the ceiling during the nights were not investigated. That's a fuck up on the prison. Imagine how they felt. By late 1977, Bundy's impending trial had become a case, so a big case in the small town of Aspen, of course, and Bundy filed a motion for a change of venue to Denver on December 23rd, the day before Christmas Eve. The Aspen trial judge granted the request, but to Colorado Springs, where the juries had historically been hostile to murder suspects. On the night of December 30th, when most of the jail staff was on Christmas break and nonviolent prisoners on furlough with their families, Bundy piled books and files in his bed to make like a dummy and to on a blanket, yep, to make a dummy to simulate him sleeping. And then he climbed into the crawl space and escaped. Blah 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 blah. He stole a car. And Bundy drove eastward out of Glenwood Springs, but the car soon broke down in the mountains. And a passing motorist gave him a ride into Vail, 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 60 miles to the east. From there, he caught a bus to Denver, where he boarded a morning flight to Chicago. In Glenwood Springs, the jail skeleton crew did not discover the escape until noon on December 31st, more than 17 hours later. By then, Bundy was already in Chicago. Interesting stuff right there, ladies and gentlemen. So in Florida, Bundy proceeded to attack about six more women. Here they are. In the early hours of January 15th, 1978, 1 week after his arrival in Tallahassee, Bundy entered the FSU's Chi Omega sorority house through a rear door with the faulty lock mechanism. Beginning at about 2:45 a.m., he bludgeoned Margaret Bowman, 21, with a piece of oak firewood as she slept, then garroted her with a nylon stocking. He then entered the bedroom of 20-year-old Lisa Levy and beat her unconscious, strangled her. Kathleen Keeler, breaking her jaw and deeply lacerating her shoulder. And Karen Chandler, who suffered a concussion, broken jaw, loss of teeth, and a crushed finger. Chandler and Keeler survived the attack. Kellner later attributed their survival to automobile headlights illuminating the interior of their room and frightening away the attacker. So, those are the Florida attacks, some of them. Two survived, two dead. After leaving the sorority house, Bundy broke into the basement apartment 8 blocks away and attacked FSU UFC student Chanel Thomas, dislocating her shoulder and fracturing her jaw and skull in 5 places. She was left with permanent deafness and equilibrium damage that ended her dance career. On Thomas's bed, police found a semen stain and a pantyhose mask containing 2 hairs similar to Bundy's in class and characteristics. Oh. So, in a parking lot, he approached a 14-year-old girl, Leslie Parmenter, the daughter of Jacksonville Police Deputy's Chief of Detectives, identifying himself as Richard Burton, Fire Department, but retreated when Parmenter's older brother arrived and challenged him. That afternoon, he backtracked 60 miles westward to Lake City. at Lake City Junior High School. The following morning, 12-year-old Kimberly Deneen Letch was summoned to her homeroom by a teacher to retrieve a forgotten purse, but was never returned to class. Several weeks later, after intensive search, her partially mummified remains were found in a pig farrowing shed near Suwannee River State Park, 35 miles northeast of Lake City. She appeared to have been raped, then killed by neck lacerations with a knife. So Bundy stole a car on February 12th and was pulled over around 1 a.m. when he was stopped by a cop, pulled over and took all that stuff. He took off running and the cop fired a warning shot followed by a second round. Great, and he gave chase and tackled him. The two struggled over Lee's gun before the officer finally subdued and arrested Bundy. In the stolen vehicle were three sets of IDs belonging to the female FSU students, 21 stolen credit cards, and a stolen television set. My guy steals random shit. Also found were a pair of dark-rimmed non-prescription glasses and a pair of plaid slacks, later identified as the disguise worn by Richard Burton Fire Department in Jacksonville. As Lee transported his suspect to jail, unaware that he had just arrested one of the FBI's 10 most wanted fugitives, he heard Bundy say, "I wish you had killed me." So Bundy had about, 8 to 10 victims in Florida, and these were all within like a few days rampage, most of them within only like 45 minutes. The four that were attacked in the sorority house all took place within 15 minutes, and then like a couple hours later, the other one took place, which is wild. So for the Florida murders, he received the death sentences for the murder convictions in Florida. 6 months later, a second trial took place in Orlando for the abduction and murder of Kimberly Letch. Bundy was found guilty once again after less than 8 hours of deliberation due to principality of testimony of an eyewitness who saw him leading Letch from the schoolyard to his stolen van. Important material evidence, including clothing fibers with an unusual manufacturing error found in the van on Letch's body, which matched fibers from the jacket Bundy was arrested in. Oh, snap. But, I think he was sentenced a third time to death for that one as well. As the sentence was announced, he reportedly stood up and shouted, "Tell the jury they were wrong." The third death sentence would be the one ultimately carried out nearly 9 years later. Holy. So again, with all of those, he would try to be a lawyer for himself, and his egocentric, narcissistic self thought he could pull it off, and he epically failed. But, and then he got the death penalty and then eventually died, obviously. But he also got married in prison. So, that's pretty, wild. But, I think he got married to Boone, and he also had a kid with her who was born in October 1981. And that is, wild. That is pretty wild. They were, she was conceived during conjugal visits that were not allowed in Rainford Prison, but inmates were known to pool their money together in order to bribe guards to allow them intimate time alone with their female visitors, which is a fairly normal-ish occurrence in prisons. So, on the days leading up to his interview, on, January 24th, 1989, he confessed to a lot of the murders, and that's how they found the majority of the bodies. And he also helped catch the Green River Killer by a serial killer analysis. I believe it was the Green River Killer. Correct me if I'm wrong. But he was executed at 7:16 a.m. on January 24th, 1989. And there were crowds of people cheering him, cheering on the execution and setting off fireworks and dancing. And yeah, that was wild. While the execution was being carried out, then cheered as the white hearse or whatever containing Bundy's corpse departed the prison. He was cremated in Gainesville, and his ashes scattered at the undisclosed location in the Cascade Range of Washington State in accordance with his will. If you want, you can go search up pictures of his dead body and find them on Google. It's pretty wild. But yeah, Ted Bundy's last meal, he refused a special request, so he was given the standard last meal on Florida's death row. Steak done medium rare, the best way. Eggs over easy. Toast with butter, a jelly. But with butter and jelly. Milk, coffee, juice, and hash browns. That's better than I'm eating right now. Like, holy. His last words were, "I'd like you to give my love to my family and friends." Those were his last words. Those are pretty, mellow last words, the words of a man who accepted his fate. But yeah, there's a bunch of documentaries and Netflix specials and movies and TV series about Ted Bundy. You could literally just search up Ted Bundy TV shows and movies and you'll they'll come up. But if you want to know more, the links to the source will be in the description below, so go check them out. Leave what I missed out in the comments if you're well-educated on this case and if you made it this far. But yeah, sorry for some of the parts that were unorganized and hard to understand and all that stuff. So that is Ted Bundy. Thank you for listening to this episode on the Murder House Radio Show. Check out the social medias and the sources in the description. Make sure you hit the like and subscribe button. Once you hit the subscribe button, hit the bell notification and select all to get all notifications if you are viewing on YouTube. Or if you're viewing on a podcast platform, hit follow. See you next time on the next episode. This is your host, X, signing off.